one might say, is one not bluffing oneself by sort of visualizing within oneself an ocean and a temple and a shrine and a, is it sanctioning hallucination? Perhaps not. They may turn around and argue, what you are seeing in front of you is hallucination. It is the other end of the spiral. The world of matter that you are seeing is already hallucination. How do you know that what you are seeing is true? Why not replace this hallucination by that? Maybe that is true. Or at least by raising that hallucination, your confirmed conviction in the reality of this world hallucination is gone. It's shaken. You sit in your own meditation room and you contemplate on all this wonderful, the ocean or the orb of the sun or the mountain or whatever you wish to contemplate on, and a throne there and somebody sitting with seven lights and seven candles. And for the time being, that appears to be absolutely real. You are able to touch that person, you are able to talk to that person. Then you open your eyes. Was it all hallucination? All that was hallucination, yeah? Peter. Sure. Maybe this is hallucination too. What's the difference? In my meditation, I saw Vishnu or Krishna or Buddha or whatever it is, Jesus or whatever it is, and he said that it's only hallucination. I come out of it and I see Peter. Maybe this is hallucination also. Something shakes within. That's enough. Then you don't take anything for granted. You are inquiring from there on. From there on, you are inquiring. And an inquiring mind never gets caught. We were talking about detachment and non-attachment yesterday. The basis of what is called non-attachment or psychological freedom is the spirit of inquiry. If this spirit of inquiry is there constantly, without let up even for a second, it never gets attached. It's questioning, merely questioning, not doubting, merely questioning. If that is hallucination, maybe this is hallucination too. And if this imaginary being called Peter turns around and says, you are a fool, must I fight with a hallucination, what for? With a phantom, what for? Therefore, the spirit of inquiry itself is the answer to attachment, detachment, non-attachment, etc., etc., the whole lot. It gives me my freedom, total freedom. Not only from external forces, but even from internal forces. Oh, I am all admiration for you. I thought I saw God there. And I was devoted to him. And I see such a good man, I am all admiration. This may be as much of an illusion as that. So I am questioning what is seen outside, I am questioning the seer also. Questioning, not doubting. The seer obviously exists. As there is an existence which is misinterpreted as the object. The subject is real, obviously real. There is a subject, but may not be as a subject. Because the word subject and the concept as a subject is directly related to the object. It is the object that creates a subject. And there is obviously an object, otherwise there is no subject. There is no vision. Hence, I am questioning the object, I am questioning the subject, but not doubting the existence of existence. So, it is in the spirit of inquiry that pure freedom is born. It may be, I am only suggesting, I don't know. The orthodox people who read this and write commentaries on it will be cross. If they are told that all this tremendous meditation is only to rouse this spirit of inquiry, maybe. But when the mind is able to reach a slightly more subtle dimension, in other words, it does not need to divert itself, it is not so restless that you have to provide it with a whole paraphernalia. That it is able to look into your eyes and be still. And the eyes don't have to wander around. That your gaze is steady. And the mind is able to be focused quite easily. When does this happen? When the whole Hatha Yoga has already been practiced. When the nerves are, when the nadis are pure, when the nerves are calm, and when the mind is steady, then the attention becomes steady too. Then from this gross meditation on an elaborate form, not only a physical form, but an elaborate form, you can visualize a single flame, Jyoti Dhyana. And I shall read this later. The Jyoti can be in the Muladhara Chakra or various other chakras, or in the between the eyebrows. Just a brilliant flame, steady, unagitated. And it is possible to contemplate that and allow the mind to be merged in it. What is known as Sukshma Dhyana is rather complicated. Complicated in the sense that one has to absorb a lot of the doctrines of Hatha Yoga before one can really grasp its significance. It involves the awakening of the Kundalini and the merging of the Kundalini in the Sahasrara, where we discuss this bindu, the point. The spiral has returned, turned upon itself and found its center, which is the bindu. And that bindu, it is said, refuses to be confined to the physical body. It is not confined to the physical body. When the Hatha Yogi practices what yesterday I referred to as Shambhavi Mudra. Shambhavi Mudra is mere vacant gaze. Not quite, but on the physical sense, it is merely vacant gaze. The eyes are open unwinkingly, unseeingly open. And it is said when this kundalini has reached that bindu, it shines as a blue diamond. And when the eyes are vacantly focused, vacantly unfocused. If it is vacant, it is not focused. It is said that this bindu or this blue pearl-like radiance emerges through the eyes, and as it were, stands in front of the yogi in that 12-inch space. I don't know if you remember, we discussed this 12-inch space, the magnetic field, the other day. Guiding him from there on in all that he has to do. Its color is said to be blue, and I'm wondering again, wondering aloud, is that why all the Indian gods are blue? Krishna is blue, Rama is blue, Vishnu is blue, all these mighty gods are blue. So, and one person, Swami Muktananda, I think you got that book Guru here? He mentions it there. That this blue pearl is seen outside. At that time, you do not know whether it is outside or inside. Because it's also inside this magnetic field, so it's both inside and outside, or no side. And in that, what he calls pearl, why not use the same word, the blue pearl, one's own personal deity is seen. Could be regarded as vision of God. These are three forms of meditation that are described in the Gheranda Samhita. Beautiful, wonderful things. I forgot to mention one thing else. In the sthula, in the gross form of meditation, one may also use one or the other of these chakras, each one of which is an elaborate mandala that can also fall under the first. And all the chakras are mandalas. And the Tibetan Buddhists and the other Buddhists, they have got any number of mandalas. And the mandala meditation is deliberately planned to be elaborate. It is both a psychological adventure and may also function as the Jungian archetype, right? And that is for the sthula dhyana. Even when you practice that sthula dhyana on the various chakras, on the various patterns, which are elaborately described and must be done, rather in no great hurry. Each chakra meditation may take about an hour. All these, the petals, and then if you keep on adding to it, integrating the whole thing with the whole, it may take quite some time. Then passing from one chakra to the other, each one is a mandala. It's a whole thing. It's a whole meditation. And if one gradually comes up in that way, once again we find that in the Ajna there is the flame. There is a light, and one contemplates the light eventually. This is the Garanda Samhita, sixth lesson. Dhyana Yoga. Garanda said, the dhyana or contemplation is of three sorts, gross, luminous and subtle. When a particular figure is contemplated on, it is sthula or gross contemplation. When Brahman or Prakriti is contemplated on as a mass of light, it is Jyotish contemplation. When Brahman as Bindu, point, or Kundali force is contemplated on, it is Sukshma or subtle contemplation. Sthula Dhyana. Let him contemplate that there is a sea of nectar in the region of his heart, that in the midst of that sea, an island of precious stones, the very sand of which is pulverized diamonds and rubies, that on all sides of it, kadamba trees laden with sweet flowers, that next to those trees, like a rampart, a row of flowering trees such as Malati, Mallika, Jati, Kesara, Champaka, Parijata and Padma, and that the fragrance of these flowers is spread all round in every quarter. In the middle of this garden, let the yogin imagine that there stands a beautiful kalpa tree having four branches representing the four Vedas, and that it is full of flowers and fruits. Beetles are humming there and cuckoos are singing. Beneath that tree, let him imagine a rich platform of precious gems, and on that a costly throne inlaid with jewels, and that on that throne sits his particular deity as taught to him by his guru. Let him contemplate on the appropriate form, ornaments and vehicle of that deity. The constant contemplation of such a form is sthula dhyana. Another process. Let the yogin imagine that in the pericarp of the great thousand-petaled lotus, there is a smaller lotus having 12 petals. Its color is white, highly luminous, having 12 bija letters, namely Ha, Sa, Ksha, Ma, La, Va, Ra, Yum, Ha, Sa, Kha, frame. In the pericarp of this smaller lotus, there are three lines forming a triangle, A, Kha, Tha, having three angles called Ha, La, Ksha. And in the middle of this triangle, there is the pranava or Om. Then let him contemplate that in that there is a beautiful seed having nada, sound, and bindu, point. On that seed there are two swans and a pair of wooden sandals. There let him contemplate his Gurudeva having two arms and three eyes, and dressed in pure white, anointed with white sandal paste, wearing garlands of white flowers, to the left of whom stands Shakti of blood-red color. By thus contemplating the Guru, this sthula dhyana is also attained. These are two different types. The second is Jyotir dhyana. I have told thee the sthula dhyana. Listen now to the contemplation of light, by which the yogin attains success and sees his self. In the Mooladhara is Kundalini in the form of a serpent. The Jivatma is there like the flame of a lamp. Contemplate on this flame as the luminous Brahman. This is Tejo Dhyana or Jyoti Dhyana. Another process. In the middle of the eyebrows, above the Manas, there is the light of Om. Let him contemplate on this flame. This is another method of contemplation of light. The third, Sukshma Dhyana. Thou hast heard the Tejo Dhyana, listen now to the Sukshma Dhyana. When By a great good fortune, the Kundalini is awakened, it joins with the Atman and leaves the body through the portals of the eyes and enjoys itself by walking in the royal road. It cannot be seen on account of its subtleness and great changeability. The yogin, however, attains this success by performing Shambhavi Mudra, that is, by gazing fixedly at space without winking. Then he will see his Sukshma Sharira or subtle body. This is called Sukshma Dhyana, difficult to be attained even by the Devas, as it is a great mystery. The contemplation on light is 100 times superior to the contemplation on form and 100,000 times superior to Tejo Dhyana is the contemplation on the Sukshma. Thus have I told you Dhyana Yoga, a most precious knowledge, for by it there is direct perception of the self. Hence, Dhyana is belauded. Oh.